So I'm going to take a different perspective here, and Neil and Christiana have been presenting analyses based on families and family reports of these things. Now, I'm going to shift and look at state policy and what we can see about the new rules under the Affordable Care Act and how that may be leaving some areas of uncertainty. So I'm going to look at the benchmark plans that states have chosen, and these are the this is the protocol under the Affordable Care Act by which states set standard minimum benefit standards for insurance in their state. State mandates about insurance coverage for kids and lingering uncertainty. And this work was supported by HRSA as well, and we have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So what I want to do here is take a look at the Affordable Care Act and both the opportunities that it, new opportunities that it provides for families and some of the remaining uncertainties. The Affordable Care Act provides new avenues to obtain health insurance coverage, and thereby gives people, families, increased choice options. It also has very strict rules about new standards of coverage. But some plan features still exist that may expose families raising kids with mental health needs to risk of out-of-pocket expenditures. And that's what I want to focus in on today as we explore how we can bring families to the point of choosing adequate insurance to meet their needs. So just as Christiana said, kids with mental health needs have historically faced insurance deficits. Nearly all of these kids have some health insurance, but families still report contributing significant amounts of money out of pocket to the cost of care. And this kind of pay-as-you-go strategy, particularly in autism, is associated with disparities in use for vulnerable families. That is, families with low income, with kids with more severe needs, racial and ethnic minorities, unmet need for care, and financial burden. So evidence on that, and still, although the states have really been working hard, both federally in terms of mental health parity and autism particularly, the evidence on the impacts of insurance coverage mandates for children with mental health needs and autism remains mixed. So the Affordable Care Act has elements to improve access to insurance. It's now available to previously excluded individuals. People with pre-existing conditions can now get insurance. You can no longer deny them insurance because of pre-existing conditions. There's subsidies for people with low income. Plans include new essential minimum benefits, and I'm going to focus on mental health benefits and habilitative services. And habilitative services are speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy that are particularly important for kids with developmental delays and autism, mental health needs. And then the health insurance marketplace provides new plan options for families. So families now can have recourse to purchase insurance beyond employer-offered plans or individually purchased plans. And there's more choice of plans in the marketplace with a standard format for comparison between them. But plan coverage of some services remains uncertain. So as I said, the protocol under the Affordable Care Act is that states choose a benchmark plan to determine minimum benefits within the state. Typically, this is their largest small group plan. Coverage of mental health and habilitative services are required under the Affordable Care Act, but the coverage can vary within and across states. And that's what I want to show to you today. It's just been a kind of blank spot in terms of our understanding of implementation of the ACA so far. The benchmark plan may or may not include state mandated health insurance benefits like those for autism. And the law allows benefit substitution. So that means that within a particular type of benefit, so mental health, habilitative, inpatient, outpatient, that kind of thing, a state plans are allowed to substitute one kind of benefit for another as long as the actuarial value remains the same. So this is particularly pertinent for autism because autism-specific benefits tend to sit within mental health. So a particular plan could say, well, autism is too unknown, that's too scary to put in my plan, I will substitute it for another mental health benefit instead. As long as the actuarial value is the same, they're allowed to do that. Or in autism also sits in habilitative services particularly. So, and then the other piece of this is that the actuarial value of these plans in the health insurance marketplaces are fixed at four different levels, but that's based on the value to a typical person in the general population, and it's not tied to the value of the benefit for a family raising a kid with complex needs, like mental health needs. So those actuarial value levels don't align for these families we're thinking about. So the bottom line is that plans can offer appealing features by restricting others. And we've heard from Christiana's report that some appealing features to families may be the ones that they see right up front in their face. And we're concerned that they may be making choices that actually restrict their coverage in other areas. So what I'm going to do today is just kind of look at where the states are with their benchmark plans to try and highlight for ourselves where these areas of uncertainty are that we should be concerned about. So to choose the best plan requires, first of all, anticipating service use. And we've heard from Neil's presentation that families really can do that. They have insights about what their kids' expenditures look like relative to other kids. And you need that in order to figure out what your plan paid and your family out-of-pocket expenditures are. And it's a function of your service use and the plan features, and that's complicated. And we know that we already know from before that families aren't very good at choosing health insurance plans. It's hard to understand cost-sharing provisions. People don't understand health insurance terms, even though they've been thrown into this marketplace where they have to pick plans. It's really difficult to compare plans. Low literacy and low numeracy impede choice. Also, families with individuals in poor health, low income, or families who have more children have a harder time making good choices. It's harder, and I think that probably means it's harder to anticipate the expenditures. And then FACT, simulation exercises of insurance exchange choices have shown that people's efforts to choose a cost-effective plan are no better than chance. That's how badly off we are, right? So what we wanted to do in this phase is to describe some of the variation in the state benchmark plans as a starting point. So we're going to look at the state rules regarding health insurance plan features. And I'm focusing on the features that are important here to families raising kids with mental health needs. So we collected the state benchmark plans and related rules as of January 2015 from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Studies. And I'm just showing simple descriptive statistics to characterize these plan features and plan offerings within and across states important to these families. So the mean number of plans offered in the health insurance marketplace is 71 with a standard deviation of 72. One state, the lowest state, offers 6 plans. Wisconsin offers 452 plans. how do you choose? The annual premium for a family of four, two adults, two kids, all non-smokers, the mean is $857. The minimum is $642, and the maximum is about $1,300. Looking at mental health outpatient benefits in the state benchmark plans, and this is states go through a process where they pick their plan. Usually it's the largest small group plan. Small group plans are the plans typically subject to state legislation about mandated benefits, but not always. And then if there are gaps in their benchmark plan, like their plan does say very few plans covered historically covered habilitative services, and so it's likely that a benchmark plan wouldn't cover that, and then states go through a rulemaking process to fill in the holes. And the rules have to align with the ACA rules. But I'll talk more about that. They're not totally prescriptive. So in terms of mental health outpatient benefits, well, 33 states say there are no limits to mental health outpatient visits. One state has different limits for people with serious mental illness and for others. So people with serious mental illness get a little over one per week, and everyone else gets 20 per year. And then a few states have specific visit numbers of visits available per year, from one a week down to 8 visits a year. In terms of mental health inpatient benefits, again, about the same number, 32 states don't have a limit on inpatient visits, but a number of states have prescriptive limits on the number of stays that a person can have. Maybe it's days. I'm sorry. We'll have to go back and check. 10 versus others. It must be days, because 60 is huge. Thank you. So in terms of habilitative services, there's a lot of variation. And as I said, that's because historically, this has been a service that hasn't been included in private health insurance. It is included under Medicaid. But now states are required to have habilitative services. But many of their benchmark plans didn't include them, so they had to go through some other process to put them into the benchmark. So 16 states don't have a limit on the number of habilitative services that a family, a kid, could use. And again, habilitative services are occupational, speech, and physical therapy. One state said we don't have limits for kids, but we do for adults. One state gave the limits in terms of dollars, and this particular state was designing these limits, thinking particularly about kids with autism. So $50,000 annually for these little kids is enough to provide applied behavioral analysis kind of services for these little kids with autism, and then it shrinks. For older kids, and there's not really good evidence out there about why that number was picked or how much those kids are using. And then a few other states have 60 visits per year, or one state had 60 visits per condition, so that a condition could go over years, but you get 60 per issue. Some other limits. And then what's most concerning here is that if a state benchmark plan didn't include habilitative services at all, and the state rulemaking process, during their rulemaking process, they did not pick some particular limit like 60 or 35 or 20, then they're allowed to leave this kind of blank in their benchmark plan. And the rule says that the benefit has to be provided in parity with some other related services, most likely rehabilitative services, and those rehabilitative service benefits are typically designed for adults, often older adults coming out of the hospital. So they're really not designed appropriately for little kids with mental health needs and autism. So They have to be either in parity or just, quote, determined by the issuer and reported. And so for 16 states, they haven't made a decision, and they haven't even said explicitly that it's going to be in parity with something else they do, which means that every issuer can just say, this is what I'm doing. And families are left with that huge variety. In terms of autism-specific benefits in the benchmark plans, first of all, taking a step back here, 40 states mandate benefits to cover specific autism-related services. These are through state legislation for insurance provided in that state. That legislation typically applies to small group plans in a state and typically excludes self-insured plans, that is, plans provided through employers that are large enough that they assume the risk of the insurance themselves. But there's variation, like some of them just apply to the state or federal employees, things like that. So 40 states have these mandates. However, only 25 of the benchmark plans include autism-specific benefits. So that's where you can see that the benchmark plans don't carry through with all the state legislation. Then there's this issue of allowing this issue of substitution of benefits. And as I said, the autism coverage is particularly at risk for being substituted in the plans offered, because within mental health and within habilitative benefits, they can take out, the plans have the choice of saying, I'll have language that covers autism-specific services, or I can take it out and just have it be general. And if it's just general, and it doesn't specifically say that autism is covered, then historically, families with kids with autism have a really hard time getting insurance to reimburse for those services. That's a whole different story. So of the 25 states that include autism-specific benefits in their benchmark plan, 12 of them allow substitution of benefits, which means that the plans that families, the choices that families offered may or may not include those autism benefits. Six states don't have any provision for substitution of benefits, which means they just didn't say, yes, you can do it, or yes, you can't. And so I think it's still up in the air, and plans could approach the insurance commissioner of the state and figure out what's going on. And then seven of them say, we don't allow substitution of benefits. And that's the one way that states can really codify that all the plan offerings will include the insurance benefits. You can see how much it narrows down. So to conclude, we see that families face a broad array of choices in the insurance marketplaces. There's significant variation in mental health services covered across states and within each state's marketplace. Most families face this vast array of plan options. So we conclude from this that families really are in need of clear information on insurance coverage terms, how plans work, how plans will work for them, and how to choose plans that meet their needs. Thinking about our work across our three presentations, from Neil's presentation, you see that families really do have important insights about their children's expenditures relative to others, and that's an important foundation for choosing good insurance. While families' insurance ratings are aligned with their out-of-pocket expenditures from Christiana's presentation, they are not aligned with the breadth and depth of services covered. So it's really a concern that families rate their insurance looking only at their out-of-pocket costs and not taking into account that their plan may actually be paying for fewer services. And so we conclude that families may not understand how to identify the best insurance to meet their needs. And the concern is that low deductible and copay plans, that is plans that lead to these low out-of-pocket costs, one, are expensive, and if you're paying an expensive premium, then that may constrain your use of uncovered services, and families with kids with mental health needs, and particularly autism, pay a huge amount out of pocket. A lot of services that families use are not covered still by any insurance. And then families may even trade off coverage of mental health services and even in an effort to get to a low out-of-pocket expensive plan. In order to afford the premium, they may end up choosing a plan with a more conscribed set of benefits that's not going to be of benefit to their kids. So, thinking about next steps, we think we need to examine the rules of state legislation, rulemaking, and implementation culture on family insurance ratings and child expenditure. So, although we have mental health parity, although we have the ACA, we have this protocol for benchmark plans, we really have no information coming out yet about how states have reacted to these rules and what plans are available to families and how even once families are connected to particular plans, how much plans in their adjudication of each particular service that kids have used are actually paying for these services. We need to explore the association between plan features and family financial burden under these reforms, and we don't know that yet. And then finally, it's been remarkable to me that we don't have it, but we need to elucidate and test a conceptual model of satisfaction with health insurance. You know, here we all are, we've passed these rules, we have health insurance, that's great, we don't know how to choose it, and we really don't know, we don't have a theory or a model of what people really value, or the elements that people may value in the individual, family, and contextual characteristics that lead families to value some pieces of insurance coverage more than others. And so we need to do that in order to move this forward. So we have a couple of ideas about implication. First, there are some policy strategies that we could implement to simplify choices for families. One thing we could do is we could reduce the number of plans offered. We could just say you can't offer 452, you can only offer 10 or 5. Or we could put in place rules that would lead to fewer offerings. And one possibility might be to limit plan variation rather than having 10 different levels of deductibles and 10 different levels of limitations on mental health benefits or rehabilitative services. You could just say you get to do low, medium, and high, and this is what they are. And that would reduce families' choices. Something that our work didn't really talk about, but that we've been learning about happening in this early ACA implementation, is the need to reduce families need to go back and do annual shopping. So because of what's happening is because of marketplace changes in health providers, big hospitals are buying up little hospitals. It's changing the set of the provider networks in particular that are connected to a particular provider. And so if a plan only covers a set of providers, the likelihood that your doctor sticks covered by your health insurance plan, is changing over time. And we can't say that provider organizations can stop moving around and buying each other, but we could put in place rules to limit mid-year change within covered providers of a health insurance plan. So we could establish rules for grandfathering established commitments, for example. And that would at least mean that a family who's chosen a plan for a year won't all of a sudden lose their preferred provider for the remainder of a year given some change. And then also, what we conclude is that families need education and tools. Families need information about insurance terms and how plan features impact their out-of-pocket costs as well as their total plan paid costs. And families need tools to synthesize the impacts of their anticipated expenditures, which they know the most about, and plan features, in order to choose adequate insurance to meet their needs. Thank you. So if you have questions for any of us, please feel free. Yes.
So first, I just want to say a big thank you for writing this paper, because, I mean, I guess as health services researchers, I'm guilty of questions who sort of think that all private insurance are the same. So when we study the impact of ACA, we sort of lock all private together. But I think it clearly demonstrates that all private insurance are not the same, and it varies by state by state. So
thank
I have
you.
Two questions. Okay. One is, have you published it?
Not yet. We're working on it.
But this is very useful information.
Thank
you. The second question is, you know, these are variations in benchmarks like with your private insurance. So I mean, is there any variation? So let's say you know maybe the expansion states, like the non-expansion states, the expansion states have better benchmarks than the non-expansion states. So we have an opportunity to look into that.
That's something we could look at. There are only 27, I can't remember, expansion states. Right. About half the states are expansion, half not. So we should look at that. I think the pertinent thing is that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Studies has been quite slow in developing their own rulemaking about how Medicaid benefits need to respond to the essential minimum benefits. And so, for example, I think it was just last summer, is that right? That they came out with rules about autism coverage. It just came out a few months ago, and states are still just reacting to what does that mean and how do we do it. So it's just not even in place.
And even when there was a lot of the states using it, but they have an interest in who in the states, how are they using it, such a black box?
It is. There's the Commonwealth Fund. Has done some descriptive work about the process, the sort of governmental process that states went through to choose their benchmark plans. Yes?
I have a question that's somewhat follows on this one. So we know that, especially for families with kids with complex needs, that oftentimes they have private insurance, and depending on the state they live in, they may also have Medicaid through waiver programs and such. And so I'm wondering if you and we know that Medicaid can often kind of be considered a richer benefit package for kids with special health care needs because of the medical necessity benefit. And so I'm wondering if in your work you looked at states where they do have waivers for kids with mental health, you know, like SMI, for instance, and how that dovetails with this work here.
Did you hear Christiana?
I didn't.
So, yes, we did.
Okay. So,
now, well, so, it, what, do you, you, go ahead. Me? Okay. So we agree with you that we think that kids that have what we call wraparound coverage, so private insurance with Medicaid wrapped around, would likely fare the best because private insurance gives them access to providers that may not accept Medicaid and opens doors that are maybe closed for Medicaid kids, but on the other hand, Medicaid will have more extensive, more deeper coverage, and they'll also cover services like habilitative services that aren't covered typically in private plans. So we thought that they would be the best off. We used a national survey of children with special health care needs to get families ratings of their insurance plan type. We thought they would rate the wraparound the highest, and they didn't. They rated Medicaid highest. And then we looked at them, used a medical expenditure panel survey to look at families' total and out-of-pocket expenditures by plan type. Again, hypothesizing that the wraparound group would get the largest amount of services because that plan is really devised to get kids all the services they needed, and that hypothesis was borne out. So we have this mismatch between family ratings and actual expenditures, and that's what's troubling and why we've been focusing on education as tools.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
So I like this explanation because it really fits the ADHD vision of let's get some data about problems that we know and are already thinking that the practical outcomes, the education, and then the policy. And I want you to appreciate that. It just came from the affiliate, the discussion with the affiliates, and I was thinking when you said the policy. We have to advocate for whatever we decide, you know, cure and whatever, in everything. I don't know enough about how that will work, but with that would be the job. But yeah, we have to come good data and science and things.
Thank you. And states are allowed to make that choice now, because some states do have payroll options. Thank you. Any other comments? Yes?
I think that's a good idea. Something that's powerful is just where do you plant as you kind of alluded to, there's a lot of people who, for lots of reasons, really want to live in China. And there's lots of big states who are being power groups that would love this information to give them the ammunition. So it's about us finding what we call the community. They're more likely to make a change. And then you get into more reflective thinking and people that are reflecting on policy. Is something that we all know, we all have our insurance system. We do this, we have to look through, you know, all these options, and you know that it isn't only about the benefit structure, it's about the culture of the institution.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and you know, something that's troubled research getting into practice for a long time. We do have relationships with some of the autism advocacy groups and with NAMI, and they've written letters of support to us saying this is important, and so you know, I hope that we can take this to them to move forward and thinking, you know, on a kind of state level in North Carolina, we have seen policy change work by getting together state government and the university and advocates and then crafting something, and then the advocates are the ones that are allowed to go to the state legislature and make a change. But it's fraught with a lot of politics. There are politics not only within state government, but within advocacy communities too. And the stature of the different, for example, autism advocacy groups is in flux. I don't know.
The political market that we're first got up.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very great.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming to this very early morning session.